The following program is a Nightingale Conant production for Simon & Schuster Audio.
Every single human being has an aspect of himself that is invisible and yet very real. This aspect of himself, which is non-material, is a field of higher intelligence, is a window to a more universal field of infinite possibilities. When you get in touch with this aspect of yourself, this higher self, you find that there's an aspect of yours which has a computing ability which is far more precise, far more accurate, and far more orderly than that which exists in the realm of rational thought.
The world of boundless freedom and infinite bliss is inside you. It is you. It's your higher self. And when you make contact with that, you'll find total fulfillment available to you every moment. Deepak Chopra is an internationally renowned physician, author, and lecturer. He's the founder of the American Association of Ayurvedic Medicine, as well as an established endocrinologist. He's the author of the best-selling books, Quantum Healing, Perfect Health, and Unconditional Life, Mastering the Forces that Shape Personal Reality. Dr. Chopra combines his knowledge of the technical, externally focused Western medical tradition with the wisdom of the internally focused metaphysical traditions of Eastern philosophies, thus merging modern science with spirituality. In this audio program, he outlines the basic structure and describes the inner workings of the human body, mind, and spirit, upon which all of life is experienced. And now, experience the magic of inner and outer fulfillment with Dr. Deepak Chopra.
For most people, spirituality has not been a very practical matter. As children, we all ask questions. What is life about? Where was I before I was born? What happens to me when I die? Why do things turn out the way they do? Is there a plan, a purpose behind the universe? Our parents provided us with few satisfactory answers to these deep questions. And as we grew up, we stopped asking them. Our concerns about deep values became secondary to the everyday thoughts, desires, and actions that fill up everyone's existence. Earning a living and raising a family are matters I must attend to here and now. Examining the purpose of my being here does not demand my immediate attention. For thousands of years, man has acknowledged that he has a spirit, an invisible aspect of himself that is connected to a higher reality, to God, to the higher self, or the soul. In some way, most people still sense, however vaguely, that this aspect of themselves cannot be ignored forever. In everyday terms, though, this age-old belief in a higher reality does not actualize itself. Why not? First of all, appearances are set against anything non-material. We are surrounded by a solid physical world in which spirit seems to exert no force, or at best a debatable influence. Moreover, leaving aside specific religious beliefs, there is a general sense that spirit is basically separate from us. Our bodies process food, air, and water perfectly well without spirit. Our minds effectively think about a million things without touching upon spirit. We find it easy to set spiritual life aside, waiting for the day when some as yet impossible leap takes us out of everyday life into a more exalted realm. Spirituality is a practical matter. So if you want to talk about it, we have to pierce the veil of physical appearances. We have to go beyond the belief system that ties us to matter as real and the non-material as unreal. We all have a bias towards things we can see, feel, hear, taste, and smell. If you look at all the notions we accept about who we are, you find that they're all based upon perceptual experiences. If you can see yourself as an isolated ego encapsulated in a package of skin and bones, this is because you can touch your skin, feel the hardness of your bones, and experience the thoughts and emotions that give your ego, your identity, its center of reference. Our bias tells us that we are a material body that has somehow learned to think. Dancing molecules in our brains create all the ideas and emotions that we identify with. But it is possible to have other experiences, equally valid, equally indisputable, that would tell us that we are much more than a body and ego, even more than body and mind. Instead of occupying a few cubic feet of space and a narrow sliver of time, we can shift our sense of self to an unbounded reality that has infinite dimensions. This higher sense of self cannot be found somewhere out there. Being an aspect of ourselves, our spirit is in here with everything else that is us. At the core of our being, the experience of spirit is not just real, it is the most real thing about us. Far from being detached from body, mind, and ego, spirit animates them all, connects them all, is them all. Although our package of skin and bones looks very convincing, it is a mask, an illusion, disguising our true self, which has no limitations. Can the higher self be awakened and integrated into everyday life? The whole process of spiritual unfoldment begins with that question, with the tantalizing possibility that on my own I can find out if indeed I am infinite instead of finite, powerful instead of weak, connected with the entire cosmos instead of isolated on a ball of rock spinning around a mediocre star. To give us a clue about what it would mean to exist beyond our accustomed boundaries, let's examine the most basic limitations we all accept: time, space, and matter. Matter seems like a good place to begin. The solidity of the world seems totally indisputable. As a fixed thing that you can see and touch, your body is also reassuringly solid. But beginning with Einstein, modern physics has assured us that this solidity is a mirage. After all, the body is made up of atoms. These atoms are particles that are whirling at lightning speeds around huge empty spaces. And the particles aren't material objects. They are fluctuations of energy and information in a huge void of energy and information. If you could see the body as it really is, you'd see that 99.9999% of it is mostly empty space. And the 0.00001% of it, which you see as matter, is also empty space. The matter is just an illusion, an artifact of our perceptual experiences. As you sift through this very solid-looking material body, you only have to go so far before you end up with a handful of nothing. This is a scientific fact. The question is, what is this nothingness? What is this empty space that makes up everything in existence? Because it's very clear that the basic raw material of the universe is that it's not material. The essential stuff of the universe is non-stuff. Because an atom, which is the basic unit of matter, is not really a solid entity. It's a void. But is this void an emptiness? Or could it be the womb of creation itself? Could it be the source of life itself? Is this non-stuff, non-matter that makes up the entire universe just emptiness? Or is it thinking non-stuff, thinking non-matter, that curves back within its own self and creates everything in existence, from matter to energy to time to space? as you dissect through the body, the various layers of organs, tissues, cells, molecules, and atoms peel away until at the subatomic realm, all that remains are bundles of energy vibrations. The nerve receptors in the body are switching stations that can take energy vibrations and turn them into touch, sight, sound, and so on. The only reason that a femur seems hard, plasma wet, and hemoglobin red is by a trick of our senses. Behind us, as a scientist once said, there is a radically ambiguous, ceaselessly flowing quantum soup. And the moment you turn around, like magicians, you turn it into solid physical reality. Through the mechanics of perception, out there is a quantum soup. In here is the world created. We're like King Midas, who could never know the true texture of a rose or the soft caress of a kiss, because everything he touched turned into gold. Literally, like that, in waking state of consciousness, we will never know the true texture of quantum reality. Only in higher states of consciousness, which we're going to talk about in this program, we can literally see that this whole world is a projection of our consciousness. As the poet Rumi said, we come whirling out of nothingness, scattering stars like dust. We have a whole different reality. We have to wake up to it. Just like when you wake up from your dream state, you can look back on the dream and you say, aha, that was the dream. So too, you can wake up from ordinary everyday reality, wake up to this higher reality, and then you look back and you say, aha, that was just another reality. I can open up to a higher dimension in which, in fact, I become a true magician. My desires get fulfilled at the mere intention of having them. I see that everything that happens to me is self-created, that whenever I'm responding to any situation, whether it's a sip of coffee or a traffic jam or a love note or criticism from a boss or rainy weather, I'm in fact responding to a signal that I generated within myself. The Vedic scriptures, on which a lot of this is based, say, curving back within myself, I create again and again and again. I create my mind, I create my body, I create my perceptual experiences. In fact, for the entire universe that I experience, I am the subtle cause. When you wake up to this reality, you recognize that the objective facts on which you casually base your reality, although fundamentally valid, are not all there is. There is a dimension to reality which has been hidden from your perceptual experiences, which is the subtle cause of this material reality. In fact, you can change material reality by going to that higher self. The key word is that our objective reality is fundamentally valid because our bodies seem real enough for all practical purposes. Yet reality is like a hero sandwich, constructed from many dissimilar layers. If you are content to remain at the layer where bones are hard and plasma wet and hemoglobin red and the material world real, that will be your reality. Expanding one's reality means probing into subtler layers of nature until you reach the ultimate layer where solidity, texture, and color all vanish into pure potentiality, into nothingness, but not an emptiness, the nothingness which is the womb of creation itself, the inner space which sends out messengers that make up your reality. However, this nothingness, as I said before, is not so much a void as a womb, which gives birth to every material and immaterial expression in the universe. The world you see, hear, and touch represents only a minute fraction of the entire spectrum of nature, no more than a few narrow channels on an infinite radio band. And few is not enough. By rigidly adhering to the boundaries of the senses, we are letting most of life slip away through our fingers. To keep everyday reality going, we have agreed to certain arbitrary rules and conventions about where reality begins and where it ends. Objective science is the keeper of these rules, performing an extremely valuable task, so long as we remember that these rules are meant to be broken. So let's talk about time. What is time? Ask a physicist. Has anyone done an experiment that shows the existence of time? In fact, no respectable physicist since the year 1913 has used the word time by itself. They talk about space-time continuums because time as we experience it is a psychological event, is a concept that we have invented in order to experience or to explain our experience of change. What I'm suggesting is that reality is much more flexible than people realize, even the reality of time, programmed by our past beliefs, which we inherited from our parents and our cultural traditions sometimes, and our indoctrination by society, the hypnosis of social conditioning. We remain localized in the boundaries handed down from generation to generation. We refuse to see that reality is open to revision. Nothing has to be accepted just because we inherited it. Thanks to our spiritual dimension, which we can define as that aspect of ourselves that does not believe in limitations because it does not experience them, we can challenge the most basic boundaries that enclose us. A wise teacher, a wise rishi in India once said to his disciple, to his student, he said, "You have enclosed yourself in a prison of space-time and causation, squeezed yourself into the volume of a body and the span of a lifetime, when in fact you are limitless, unbounded. This world that you see is of your own creation. It is an artifact of your own perception. When you really know your spiritual dimension, you will realize that you're not in the body. The body is in you. You're not in the mind. The mind is in you. You're not even in the world. The world is in you. Body, mind, and world happen to you because you find them interesting. Curving back within yourself, you create it all." We have already talked about the illusion of matter, but time is a similar illusion. A clock tells time by ticking away the hours and minutes, independent of our influence. But from another viewpoint, all this is only a show of objectivity. We have made a collective agreement that time has certain unalterable features. It moves forward. It is measured by clocks. It is uniform everywhere, and it waits for no man. Yet this agreement is not ironclad, and at certain moments, time turns inexplicably flexible. Recently, a Swiss friend of mine, also a physician, read me a curious and moving newspaper story about a coal mine disaster in Germany. A small group of miners were trapped underground after a massive cave-in. They realized that the air in the mine shaft would last only a limited number of hours. As it turned out, only one of the group was wearing a wristwatch, and he began to announce the time while the group anxiously waited for rescue. And to sustain hope in the others, he did not announce the right time. Instead, he called out 1 hour whenever 2 hours had actually passed. 6 days later, a rescue team found the men and were astonished that they were all still alive, with one exception, the man who wore the watch. In essence, the man with the watch fooled the others into breaking their agreement about what constituted real time. Tragically, he could not fool himself. Can it be that time will wait for one man and overtake another, depending on what each one expects? Recently, I read another case report about a study that was done in California in the spring of 1990. Sociologists from the University of California and San Diego reported that Chinese mortality dropped by 35% the week before the Harvest Moon Festival, one of the most auspicious days in the Chinese calendar, and one where special importance is given to elders. When the festival ended, death rates climbed again, and by a week later were 34% higher than normal. This really implies that people who are near death can postpone their passing in order to savor a day that is special to them. They have beaten time itself. Finally, cardiologists have pondered the fact that heart attacks are higher at 9 o'clock on Monday morning than in any other time of the week. This is not exactly a randomly chosen hour. For many people, going back to work after the weekend is a return to harsher realities. Have some of them found the drastic escape route of suffering a heart attack instead of punching the time clock again? These examples are limited to biological time, the hidden clock in our cells. To see truly comprehensive mastery of time, one must turn to dreams. In your dreams, time lacks any fixed sequence or logic altogether. It can go backwards or forwards, speed up or slow down, come to a halt or simply disappear. Many dream events are frozen in a kind of no time, without beginning, without ending. When we wake up to the world of reliable clocks, time resumes its creeping pace, but that proves little about its real nature. Suppose a man is sitting in a room, idly looking out the window. Morning, noon, and evening go by. He passively stares at people as they parade before him and watches the events taking place on the street. The same man could go to sleep at night and witness the exact same people and events in a dream, but now morning, noon, and evening occupy only 2 minutes of his sleep. Like the rest of his dream, time was created by his brain. In what way is waking time any different? The same brain processes the passage of time in both cases. Therefore, waking time and dream time could both be self-created. You know, and if you read Stephen Hawking's book, Brief History of Time, in the introduction by Carl Sagan, you find the following statement. Stephen Hawking set out to understand the mind of God, came to the conclusion that we live in a universe that has no beginning in time, no ending in time, no outer edges in space. Please try and conceptualize that, visualize that with all your might, and you'll find that it's impossible. How can you even conceptualize or visualize or imagine a beginningless universe, something that never began? So, of course, you might want to compromise and say maybe there was a beginning. And then the immediate dilemma is, what's there before the beginning? If you say there's an end, then the immediate dilemma is, what's there after the end? If you say there are outer edges in space, the immediate dilemma is, what's there after the outermost edge? So you see, quantum physics is not only stranger than we think it is, it's stranger than we can think. Because the way we can think, rationality, logically structured, linguistically structured, verbally elite thought, is just a justification of our reality map, which is based on material existence. When the reality map changes, then the territory changes also. The true nature of reality is that it is infinite, unbounded, eternal. It is the process of thinking that takes that unbounded, infinite nature of the universe and breaks them into conceptual boundaries. This is so-called rationality, linguistically structured thought, a justification for our reality map. There's no worse fate than to be caught in the clutches of this kind of rationality, because it prevents you from getting in touch with that higher self. So, if time itself is only a personal perception, liable to the same fluctuations as mood, reverie, fantasy, or any other passing thought, then we should be able to change it. All of us exercise some ability to manipulate time according to our whims. If I'm languishing in a dentist's waiting room, my unhappiness makes time drag. To speed it up, I need only go somewhere else, perhaps to a good restaurant, where I can enjoy myself again. If I've turned to something I find deeply enjoyable, time begins to fly. The difference between slow time, dragging time, and swift, fleeting time resides in me, in my perception of the situation. As long as I'm free to move from the dentist to the restaurant, I have personal control over how it feels to me, how I experience time. Because ultimately time is conceived in consciousness, it's processed in the brain, and it is metabolized in the body. I take that experience of time, which is non-material, and turn it into a biological clock. And how I do that really determines many things, including how I age, how entropy or disorder takes place in my life, whether I'm healthy or not. All these are based on personal perceptions of time. The flow of linear time is a purely psychological event. For example, if I'm forced by a sense of duty to remain at the dentist, then I have no choice but to experience the creeping kind of time that is offered there. This sort of compulsion has trapped us all. We stay in the same time frame day after day because we think we have to or ought to. But this is only an agreement we made somewhere along the line. We have even forgotten when, in reality, anyone can break free and reassert their ability to control time. Most people have a time-bound awareness. And the reason is they have sacrificed their self for their self-image. The self-image is our social persona, the protective veneer, the mask behind which we hide. The self-image is intellectual, it calculates, it determines its behaviors in anticipation of other people's responses. The self-image, therefore, is a fear-based, time-bound awareness. On the other hand, the self feels. It's from the heart. The self has a built-in response to every situation as it occurs. The awareness of the self is supremely concentrated in the present. The self doesn't calculate. It feels, and it goes with the feeling. The right response to every situation as it occurs, because life is so supremely concentrated in the present. When we go back to ourself, the higher self, and we'll be talking about various means to do that, then we'll realize that, in fact, here there is only eternity, that we can carry the consciousness of eternity wherever we go. I was quoting this Indian teacher from a little while ago who said to his student, "You've trapped yourself in the boundaries of space, time, and causation, and this is because of your self-imposed illusion. And all your conflicts arise because of this. Birth and death, pain and pleasure, hope and fear. To end these problems, you must first end the illusion." "But how is this done?" the student asked. And the master replied, "You are caught in this world like a fish in a net. But all nets have holes. Find one, escape through it, and you will see what reality actually is." Time is just such a net. It appears objectively real, but in fact, maybe no more than a notion fostered in our minds. If we understand at a very deep level of our awareness that the flow of time is a psychological event and how we experience time is up to us, then just that insight, just that knowledge can cause a mutation in our awareness. And when that change occurs in our awareness, then the body responds, because the body is nothing other than an expression, a projection, a three-dimensional movie that is being projected by that spirit, by that essential ground state from where we come. Our basic mistake is that we tend to think that time is outside of us, but it is just as much inside, packaged as memory. To remember is to take your body time-traveling, even though you do not leave your chair. For example, if I vividly remember being scared in a dark alley when I was 6, my heart starts to thump like a 6-year-old's again. The mind can also project the body forward in time. I have seen 20-year-old women, on being told that they have cancer, instantly age before my eyes, becoming as worn as someone who has battled the disease for years. What we are seeing here is that to go beyond time simply means to reclaim your right to control time as a basic aspect of yourself. Living in the eternal present, which sounds like such a lofty spiritual goal, just comes down to recovering yourself and knowing what you can do. Most of us have no idea what we can do because we are totally conditioned by the past. Our memories, beliefs, assumptions, prejudices, and stresses conspire to trap us in one boundary after another. We need to escape from this. We need to escape from the known. Most people talk about fear of the unknown. If there's anything to fear, it is the known. Because the known is the rigid patterns of past conditioning. The unknown is the field of infinite possibilities. That field of infinite choices into which we can step every moment of our life when we go beyond the camouflage of our past memories, our conditioning. Then we begin to see the world with fresh eyes, through the eyes of innocence, through the eyes of a child, through the eyes of God. And this process comes about by going beyond thought. It comes about by going into the gap between our thoughts. Because I'm not my thoughts. I'm the thinker who has those thoughts. And that part of me is unchanged. It is the timeless essence in every experience. In every experience, there is one aspect of that experience that never changes. That's the experiencer. To get in touch with the experiencer, T.S. Eliot once said, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." That place is timeless. Judgment is one of the most important ways that the mind has for feeling good about itself. Anytime we find ourselves in a psychologically threatening situation, the mind faces a decision. Will this person hurt me? Is it dangerous to feel this emotion? Dare I say what I really think? Whatever answer the mind comes up with becomes the provisional reality we operate with. And the shifting, jumbled heap that these provisional realities amount to becomes reality itself. Since life never ceases bringing us a new wave of challenge every day, the intellectual decisions we make spin on forever. The number of questions that arise over the tiniest experience is awe-inspiring. Making correct choices enables us to feel better about ourselves. Instead of having an angry outburst at a rude sales clerk, we refrain, choosing instead to do the quote-unquote right thing. And this control over our anger brings a measure of satisfaction. It is almost inconceivable to the mind that it might operate non-judgmentally. The very idea arouses considerable fear, particularly if one has accepted the prevailing notion that the world is a dangerous place, to be negotiated with care. Judgments of every kind have been ingrained in all of us since childhood. They form the bulk of our past conditioning. And therefore, it is crucial to look at the whole mechanism of judgment if we want to get past our conditioning into a new area of personal freedom. Calling someone judgmental can be taken as a serious affront because it implies a habit of condemning and criticizing. A judgmental person looks for faults in others to disguise his own faults. He puts other people's weaknesses in a glaring light in order to achieve a false sense of strength for himself. As they mature, most people try to overcome these tendencies, and our society places a high value on tolerance and openness towards other people's viewpoints. However, the mechanism of judgment plays such an indispensable part in the mind that we can fairly say it is present in all of us, whether we consider ourselves judgmental or not. It is only natural to want to feel that you've made right choices in your life. This implies a whole host of wrong choices that could have been made, and lurking behind all those wrong choices is the mind's habit of using right and wrong as a basic criterion for decision making. There is a hidden trap, however, in the assumption that right and wrong are necessary. How can we ever be certain that we have truly seen what is right and what is wrong? Isn't there the possibility that we are instead making things right and wrong, setting up our own judgments as law without examining if they were really made on a trustworthy basis? If I see an old enemy who insulted me 10 years ago, I will find it almost impossible to overlook my former injury. The old image crops up in my mind automatically. erecting a wall, and the person who could have been my friend is shut out, rejected in advance. In turn, when he senses my coldness, his defenses are raised until we both find ourselves hiding behind barricades that serve no purpose, that lack all reality. The moment of judgment may soon pass, and yet there is no relationship at all with my old enemy, quote-unquote, only the stale repetition of outworn memories. And the horror is that my tormentor today is myself left over from yesterday. So by allowing our judgments to camouflage our present experiences, we lose touch with reality. We are no longer alive, no longer sensitive to the presence of our spirit, our awareness, our eternal being that animates every moment of our existence. In and of itself, reality is neither right nor wrong. Reality exists. It has the quality of being, which is the supreme quality of life. If we tried to withstand the full force of life in its infinite power, our minds would be overwhelmed in one instant. Billions of bits of sense data bombard us every second, out of which we choose an extremely narrow band to be labeled as real. This process of selecting and narrowing down happens automatically through our senses. Our eyes cannot see the infrared light sensed by snakes. Our ears cannot hear the ultrasound picked up by bats. Our sense of touch cannot feel the ground shake when another person approaches us, although that is evident to almost all small mammals. The fact that our senses hem us in does not automatically lead to psychological damage. There are other, much more dangerous boundaries imposed by the intellect. The intellect is the mind's decision maker. The intellect looks upon the vast array of possibilities afforded by every moment of life and naturally feels overwhelmed. So it has decided to make models. A model is a small representation, a reduction of the real thing. We all carry them around in our heads. We have an idea of the model child, the model woman, the model lifestyle. Often we call these our ideals. To say I didn't have an ideal childhood basically means the way you were treated by your parents doesn't live up to a model of child rearing you have stored inside your head. Models are extremely useful because whenever we come up against a new experience, we can hold a model up, judge how the new experience compares to it, and instantly know where we stand. Using models, we convert the unknown into the known. For a new experience is always unknown, while our past, the source of our models, is reassuringly known. The mind craves continuity. It doesn't want to be surprised by every moment of existence. Therefore, no matter how open-minded you consider yourself, relying on inner models forms an important part of your everyday mental activity. It's important to realize that those models, those pictures of reality that we carry around inside, are not reality itself. They do not convey the inner content of experience except as it matches some old context. Take an example as simple as eating an ice cream cone. We all know that this simple act is rarely free of value judgments. Will eating this make me fat? Will it spoil my appetite? Was I good enough to reward myself this way? Is this brand as good as brand X? Will I ever find the ideal chocolate ice cream? Such questions endlessly arise from the insignificant act of eating an ice cream cone. They arouse powerful feelings in us because we all identify with the context that makes this small act meaningful. In the process of mistaking the model for the real thing, the context for the content, the genuine experience of eating an ice cream cone slips through our fingers. A context is just a personal association that you have with something. And eating is full of contextual meaning for everyone. arousing extremely powerful emotions that have nothing to do with the actual content of any meal. I have met anorexic patients who feel faint and nauseated at the sight of dessert. For them, contextual feelings can be crippling. They are so out of proportion with the simple act of eating. Even though it is easy to see how judgments bring great limitation to our lives, the mind will struggle desperately to hold on to them, because judgment is both a defense and a means of being happy. As a means of being happy, it gives us neat slices of reality, our personal likes and dislikes, that we can take pride in. What I like is me, what I dislike is not me. But neither one is you. As a means of creating happiness, this whole business of making right and making wrong defers happiness. The Chinese poet Wu Men has written these haunting lines. 10,000 flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, snow in winter. If your mind is not clouded by unnecessary things, this is the best season of your life. The unnecessary things of which he speaks are judgments. You can instantly tell if someone is free of judgments by asking if this is the best time in his life. If he's truly without judgment, which means without regrets or expectations, the answer has to be yes. There is no other choice. The judging mind has been so ingrained with deferring experience that even its moments of deepest happiness are shadowed by the prospect of something better or something worse. Something I wish I hadn't done. Something I want to do but can't. And this brings in the role of using judgments as defense. We all defend ourselves with self-justifications, knowing deep down that we cannot face the risk of asking for total happiness. We say things like, I'm too busy now. I'll be happy when I'm successful. Today's not a good day. I'll be happy tomorrow. I can't be happy with you. You're not up to my standards. I'll be happy when I get what I want. Life is less risky if you're good and measure up to the norm. I'm happy as the next person. How often have we used such phrases to justify a basic sense of self-defeat? In each rationalization, one hears the victory of the head over the heart. The heart's most fundamental desire, to be content in the here and now, without doubt or equivocations, has been denied. The experience of being happy is no longer immediate. It has become a distant or near prospect, an idea rather than a feeling. The trap of judgment is that one begins to believe that such self-imposed limitation is completely justified. A person who says, I have found the world's best chocolate ice cream, feels a certain sense of added self-esteem in having made that judgment. At the same time, he's guarding himself from the fear that his self-esteem may need such artificial bolstering to keep it from collapsing altogether. Rationally, the mind knows that no brand of ice cream, no make of car, no huge salary or palatial house is the same as me. I am this ice cream cone is an absurd statement. Yet, judgment is basically equating the two. Most people find it extremely difficult to tell someone how much money they actually make. This is because they believe at the gut level of emotion that I am worth only what I earn. Even if your salary runs into seven figures, to equate yourself with your earning ability misses one fundamental point. You are of infinite worth, and no amount of money can possibly equal that. Infinite worth has to be experienced, however, in order to be real. It is a subjective status that causes objective reality to present a different face. The process of rising to any higher status begins inside and is then mirrored outside. So by relying on judgment, we stunt the process of self-expansion or shut it down entirely. Every time you impose a model over reality, you are judging. And in judging, you are limiting yourself. Inside each of us, there is an infallible knower, which has the capacity to withstand the full force of reality and welcome it joyfully. No amount of love can threaten or overwhelm it. No emotion is beyond its acceptance. No outer experience can shake its unbounded status. So we have to make a distinction between this inner knower and the mind with all its judgments. The distinction has to do with the directness of experience. To the knower, all experience comes directly without filters or defenses. To the mind, on the other hand, all experience is indirect because it has to be sifted through the judgment process. Let me dwell for a moment on the experience of being loved. To a newborn baby, the whole issue of whether it deserves to be loved doesn't exist. Babies feel extreme delight, the loving touch and glance of their mothers. The bonding of self and experience is total. This is as close to unconditional love as most people get in their lifetime, despite the fact that a baby is not really loving unconditionally. Its love precedes conditions. Once the mother shows anger or disapproval, conditions start to arise. The message is sent, "I won't love you unless." Children receive these messages with great intuitive accuracy, and within the first year they have learned to gauge how much love it is safe to give or receive. How much affection can be demanded under what circumstances? The whole process of judging reality has begun. It is undeniably true that every adult carries a buried child within. But even more important, I think, is this more basic entity, judgment, that began in earliest childhood. A person who has worked through childhood pain will still feel perfectly right in judging how much love to give or receive, accept or reject. The love between husband and wife is different than that between friends. The total acceptance a mother might feel for her own child is not extended to a child down the block, much less to a child in Ethiopia. Instead of considering that all love might be perfect, the mind weighs love according to each situation. Nor is this a conscious act, since we cannot help feeling much more love for certain people than for others, as our past conditioning dictates. Love is a highly charged word for all of us. We feel threatened if someone implies that we are unloving or unlovable. Yet if we trace our judgments back to their source, the root cause of our problems with love rest on those little decisions made long ago in childhood that separated us from love itself. The direct, unlimited, unjudged love each of us deserves. Love has been judged against because we have judged against ourselves. Now you can see how very different are the two modes which nature has opened to us. The mode of the knower, who accepts reality directly, and the mode of the judgmental mind, which screens reality through models. If we ask where reality can be found, it is nowhere but in the direct experience of the inner knower. Being in the present moment, the knower has no sense of guilt from the past or fear of the future. These two ingredients are embedded in all judgments. Our great need to label things as good and bad, right and wrong, is based on the pain we experienced when we were judged as good or bad, right or wrong. Guilt reminds us which things these are. Fear warns us that they may again arise tomorrow. Strangely, we keep paying the price for punishment we have already received. The knower is above punishment because it accepts that the price has already been paid for past mistakes. Nature's deepest form of forgiveness is to allow us to forget the past. Guilt believes otherwise, insisting on unending atonement every time a past mistake is remembered. The knower is above punishment because it has relinquished its need to judge. Today I will judge nothing that occurs. Non-judgment creates silence in my mind. I'll shed the burden of judgment that I have carried with me. It's a heavy burden. And when I shed it, I'll be free as a leaf in the wind. It's a huge burden. It is to associate memories with certain events. And then every time we are confronted with any situation, we evoke that past memory. The boundaries that the human mind lives inside are invariably fashioned from the past. It is yesterday's hurt that I am defending against today. Last year's glory I want to relive. A bygone love I want to find again. Yet no matter how gratifying one aspect of life becomes, its satisfaction is limited. It wears itself out unless one finds a way to remain connected to the source of renewal. Renewal is one of life's primary urges, but even more important, since all of life depends upon it to keep ahead of tireless destruction. There is never pure destruction in nature, but creation and destruction go together, so closely spliced that they cannot be separated. We are constantly dying and being born at the same instant. Every minute, millions of ourselves divide, giving up their old existence in a death that gives birth to new cells. The impulse of creation pushes life ahead, even while the past is gobbling up life from behind. We have a deep psychological drive to keep pace with this process. Alice Miller puts it with beautiful conciseness. To quote her, there are needs that can and should be satisfied in the present. Among these is every human being's central need to express himself, to show himself to the world as he really is, in word, in gesture, in behavior, in every genuine utterance from the baby's cry to the artist's creation. The key to this inspiring affirmation is that life needs to be satisfying in the present. The great physicist Erwin Schrödinger once remarked, "The present is the only thing that has no end." By this he meant that each second of time is an eternal renewal. From one perspective, the present is the thinnest possible slice of time, the fleeting instant that allows the future to flip-flop into the past. From the opposite perspective, the present is eternal because it is ever renewing, like a river that is never the same twice. If you think about it, you will realize that the present moment is also the one thing you cannot capture in any image or any model. There is no time even to apply a model. In this realization, there's a tremendous sense of freedom. Because as soon as the present is accepted for what it is, unending, unique, unjudgeable, every second of life becomes inclusive. Again, to quote a rishi, said, "Have your attention on what is and see its fullness in every moment. There is nothing except what is here now. Therefore, the now is everything. If you seek the joy, this freedom begins. Know that it must be independent of everything you have been judging as painful or pleasurable. Freedom is nothing but being yourself. It rests on the basic feeling of I am, which has no connotation of pain or pleasure, only the peace of existing for your own sake, which is the highest bliss." Again, to quote Athir, said, "Happiness, which has reasons for it, is only another form of misery. But bliss is when you're happy for no reason whatsoever, in the mere fact of existence. And when I know this bliss, then I know that it is closer to me than my mind, nearer to me than my body, and it follows me wherever I go." Your inner knower is in contact with the source of renewal. If only you can get past the judgments that separate you from that ever-present experience. This requires the basic decision to seek happiness not in outside things, but in yourself, which we've already discussed as the starting point of spiritual unfoldment. Once you begin to refer to yourself as the source, the goal, and the path toward all happiness, judgment begins to dissolve, because it is no longer necessary. An ego that looks out on a dangerous world feels threatened because everything out there is unpredictable. The self is ever the same, however, and present in all things. Therefore, it has nothing to fear and nothing to defend against. It replaces the need to judge with one thing, complete acceptance. Judgment would be much easier to eliminate if we could face it directly. But a strong force called denial must be confronted first. Denial basically is the feeling that judgment is not being held. It says, I'm not making right or making wrong. Things just are right or wrong. The most fearful people often think they have no fear at all, because their minds deny that fear is a personal construct. To them, being afraid to fly is only logical, since airplanes do sometimes crash. Being afraid of failure is reasonable, because failure occurs all the time. Being afraid of death is inevitable, because everybody dies. Denial also sets the trap that there is no problem. The myth we cling to of, I'm not afraid, I'm not guilty, I hold on to anger, enables us to maintain a sense of self-control. It confers power at the expense of feeling, and unfortunately, many people are ready to make that bargain. In return for feeling numb against fear, guilt, anger, and pain, they can believe in their supreme self-control. This bargain exacts a high price, however. Denial makes it literally impossible for the flow of bliss to be experienced, because bliss rides on the current of natural feeling. The rigidity of self-control also dooms us to constantly repeating the same basic habits, obsessing about the same complaints, being driven into the same compulsive acts. Repetition is inevitable when you refuse to give space to the present moment. Denial also takes an enormous amount of effort, because the fear and distrust that underlie that have to be kept down forcefully. At its most desperate, denial will also extend to controlling others, those friends and family who might expose the obvious conflicts that boil inside us. Since we live in a materialistic society, all these negative consequences could still be ignored, since they are merely psychological, and the whole message of denial is that the psyche deserves its discomfort. But now we know that suppressing our real feelings leads to risks of illness, ranging from migraine and hypertension to increased incidence of heart attacks and cancer. The need to make wrong creates intolerable negativity in all areas of life. How then do we break through denial and begin to banish judgments? Psychological means are often of limited value, since by definition, denial consists of those things you don't want to see. They lie on the blind side that all of us have kept hidden as long as we can. Yet denial is really only a wrinkle in our consciousness, a peculiarly deep stress, but a stress nonetheless. Therefore, through meditation, the deep dissolving of stress releases denial and allows judgments to melt away. As the mind settles into its own deeper nature, it fuses with the knower. This automatically removes the duality between mind and knower. Direct experience becomes a real possibility once more. The knower feels no need to analyze and confront one's judgments. Instead, one will just be. And anyone who can just be has no desire to judge. We should all anticipate this effortless release of inner judgments. But along the way, certain attitudes are very helpful. First, forgive yourself for judging. Realize that holding judgment was a necessary phase for your mind to go through as long as it needed to defend yourself. acknowledging that you hold judgments will enable them to go away more quickly. To maintain that you are non-judgmental is denial, the main defense that all judgment hides behind. You can sincerely say, it's okay for my mind to be judgmental, because you're simply accepting a fact. Moreover, to forgive yourself for making judgments eliminates the need to examine every judgment one at a time. We have all spent years deciding right and wrong, good and bad. We've wasted enormous energy making other people worthy or unworthy in our eyes. Trying to forgive yourself for all these judgments is both unrealistic and pointless. As you cease to see yourself in terms of what your mind likes or dislikes, the absence of judgment will do much more than make you happier. It will open up a new world in which complete fulfillment is the normal expectation in every moment. The knower is always fulfilled. It knows no other state. The mind, however, always needs to ask, am I really enjoying this? You know, every time you experience judgment, you'll also experience some discomfort in your body. It's an automatic mechanism that occurs. Anytime you are judging, there will be a signal. The universe is very intelligent. This flow of creative intelligence in the universe, very smart, sends you two signals all the time. One's a signal of comfort. The other's a signal of discomfort. Every time you catch yourself judging, just go inside your body and feel that signal of discomfort. It'll remind you, today I shall judge nothing that occurs. Non-judgment creates silence in my mind. And when there's silence in my mind, then there's the flow of bliss in my body. To be free of its defensiveness, the mind must be joined with the knower. Bolstered by inner contentment, your mind will no longer resort to obsessions and compulsions because it will not need them. The whole issue of self-control will evaporate, and the energy wasted in suppressing one's true feelings will be released for the all-important business of living life to the fullest. Every present moment will offer itself as it truly is, a window onto eternity, a doorway to the infinite.